I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, Haitians in America react to the unspeakable horror in their home country and also how Americans can help. But first, the much-anticipated Capitol Hill Bank hearing, top CEOs testifying on the financial crisis before the new independent commission led by former California Treasurer Phil Angelides. Here's Lloyd Blankfein, chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs.
I know we all rationalized the way a lot of people, other people, had rationalized. Gosh, the world is getting wealthier, technology has done things, things are more efficient, interest, there's no inflation, things belong low, these businesses are going to do well. And I think we talked, much as a lot of the world did, talked yourself into a place of complacency.
But was it complacency or collusion? The big question going into the hearings, did companies like Goldman Sachs in fact create lousy financial instruments, bet on them to fail, but get rating agencies to give them a high rating and then sell them to unsuspecting clients so when the instruments did fail, it drove up Goldman's profits? Wall Street Journal columnist David Widener has been following all of this. He joins us. David, were the banks asked about this practice?
Yes, there were, and specific practices in the case of Goldman Sachs as well. And the answer that Lloyd Blankfein and the other CEOs gathered gave the commission was that we just didn't know. We didn't know. And this is the same line that they've been giving over the last 2 years, that we had no idea.
Well, in fact, we have, before you go on there, we have an exchange between Phil Angelides and Goldman Sachs CEO Blankfein on this issue. Let's listen.
I'm just going to be blunt with you. It sounds to me a little bit like selling a car with faulty brakes and then buying an insurance policy on the buyer of those cars. It doesn't seem to me that that's a practice that inspires confidence in the markets.
Every
I'm not talking about your own positions.
Every
I'm talking about betting against
of an asset here is an institution, okay, probably professional-only investors dedicated, in most cases, to this business.
Representing pension funds who have the life savings of police officers,
these
teachers.
Are the professional investors who want this exposure. Let me ask you, in the current market today,
because of time.
I think these are important matters. I think this is one of the most critical questions that are revolving around here.
David Widener, what a wonderful description from Phil Angelides that this practice of shorting, you know, betting against yourself is like him selling a car without brakes and then buying insurance on it. Who's winning those rounds, though?
Robin, that was a fantastic exchange, and here's why. That really told these guys, it was a wake-up call to them, that this is not your average congressional hearing before the House Finance Committee, because this panel has been picked. These are people who have worked in the industry or know the industry very well, worked with the industry. They know Wall Street inside and out, which, of course, congressmen can't be expected to know the sophisticated finance that happens there. This panel does, and that exchange between Angelides really got under Blankfein's skin. I have not seen Blankfein really get worked up like that and feel get pushed into a corner the way he was with that questioning. And that's the difference between this panel and some of the congressional hearings that we've heard over about the financial crisis over the last couple of years.
Well, another big theme we hear was employee pay. Banks expected to start announcing billions of dollars in bonuses this Friday as their earning reports come in. On this point, there's a lot of defensiveness. Here's Brian Moynihan. He's the brand new CEO of Bank of America, trying to make the case that not all of his employees played a role in the crisis. Let's listen.
Well, some employees were asked to leave the company over the past couple of years. We believe our 300,000 employees are a valuable part of our future, and we need to pay them competitively to ensure that we can keep them so they can help our clients.
And David Widener, we yesterday in the program mentioned that London now taxes bonuses by 50%. The EU wants to do the same. Are these companies going to make the case that they're going to lose people if they start, taxing these bonuses?
Well, there's an issue with this idea of competitiveness around the world. The G20 was supposed to get everybody on the same page when it comes to reforming the financial industry across the globe. Unfortunately, I think what's happened is that each country has kind of taken its own tax when it comes to the details. So in the U.S., we're talking about bank fees. We have a Paysar. We have the Fed over in London. They have bonuses. That bonus tax you talked about. And so what's happening is there's kind of an arbitrage going on. Banks are threatening each country, saying we're going to move this business out, we're going to move these bankers out because of bonus tax or financial transactions tax. And so they're playing this arbitrage game and working that very effectively to sort of tamp down these reforms that were supposed to change the situation.
Of course, a solution to that would be an international agreement.
That's right, and I think the countries of the world, the regulators of the world, need to get back together and get a little more agreement in terms of the details.
That's Wall Street Journal columnist David Widener. David, we've got about 30 seconds left. In those 30 seconds, just how are these hearings going? The tone, is it what you expected?
It's a little bit more encouraging because it is. You do have experts challenging experts, and so the level of debate is a little more complicated. But for those of us who follow Wall Street, it's a little more revealing.
And some might say maybe a little more about time. David, we'll check back in with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now to Haiti. There are reports that the main prison in the country has collapsed, inmates escaping. The country's president, René Préval, is describing stepping over bodies, a parliament that's collapsed, the tax office collapsed, schools, hospitals collapsed. The death toll is still unclear after the 7.0 earthquake struck Haiti yesterday. Video, including this one on YouTube, capture some of the earthquake's immediate panic.
The world is coming to an end!
The UN says at least 5 staff members have been killed, but many, many more remain missing, including the head of their mission there. 8 agencies trying to get in. The airport, which was damaged and closed, is now operational. How are Haitians in America reacting to all of this? Well, joining us first, Jean-Robert Saville from Radio Soleil in Brooklyn. Jean-Robert, can you tell us, first of all, what you're hearing from friends and family in Haiti?
I just spoke to my brother, who is in Haiti, actually, and he told me that this is really catastrophic in Haiti.
What else does your brother say?
The situation is very critical. The people, they are in the streets right now because they are afraid to go back to their house. There have been about 30 or 35 aftershocks. And my brother said to me that he cannot describe. You have to be on the field to see what is happening right now in Haiti.
Jean-Robert, I'm seeing terrible pictures from Radio Teleguinée in Haiti.
Yeah, Teleguinée, yes.
On their website, just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable because everybody is screaming. And some people, they are thinking that this is like something, a wake-up call from God, telling the people of Haiti that they have to change their way of living right now.
Well, we understand if they're looking at it in a spiritual way.
In a spiritual way, that's exactly.
It may also be because do we understand that a major church has been flattened and there are...
Yeah, the cathedral.
Yeah, the cathedral.
Yes, in Port-au-Prince. It has been crippled.
And the archbishop, apparently, of Port-au-Prince, it's being reported, has died.
Yes, this is the first time people are seeing something like that happen in Haiti. I think this is going to leave something very, very bad memory of this earthquake in Haiti.
Jean-Robert, how are you hearing from people in Haiti? Is it text messages?
Some people are sending me emails, some of them, because the communication by phone is really impossible right now.
I'm reading a message on Boston's gathering place for Haitians. It's bostonhaitian.com, the website here in Boston. And somebody's writing about Pétionville.
It's like about 10 miles from the north of Port-au-Prince.
Well, this person writes on bostonhaitian.com, heavy machinery needed in Pétionville. My brother-in-law's wife, Emily Sanson-Rojou, from the UN Human Resources, survived the earthquake because her UN office was a shipping container. She made her way back to the hotel, but the hotel has collapsed. The family is trapped, my brother-in-law and 3 little girls. She can hear at least 2 of their voices. And needs urgent help to get
them. A lot of damages in Pétionville because, you know, it's in the mountain. And you know, the construction in Haiti is really arbitrary because there is no rules, nothing. And people are, you know, building houses is anyhow in Haiti, and that's the problem.
Well, and they're writing that the Hotel Caribe has collapsed there, and there's a family.
There are two major hotels that are crippled right now, and where the UN people are living, that they are staying, stationed there. I think it's Hotel Montana. That hotel is flattened out.
Well, and the Caribe Hotel apparently as well, and these are, you're right, these are UN workers.
UN force keeping people, yes. This is what is happening because Haiti doesn't have the equipment, necessary to deal with that kind of catastrophe. And a lot of people probably will die because of that.
But let me ask you, though, just because it's so hard to get information out, we were also hearing this morning that there are other outlying areas, rural areas, that were not all affected but still have lost phone service. So it's very hard to find out. And that brings me to your listeners. What are they saying to you? They must be desperate to know how their families
are. Well, people over here, they don't know what to do because they are trying to get in touch with their families in Haiti. They couldn't get in touch because there is no way of communicating with those people. And they don't know exactly what is happening to their families in Haiti. Hmm. So they are desperate now. They don't know what to do, where to go, and who to call. And that situation makes them really in a bad situation now.
Richard Mombert, we have a substantial Haitian community here in Boston. You have one in Brooklyn. Are there communities across the country? Because I'm thinking that people might be able to go to local websites for Haitian communities because there are buttons there where you can go directly to the Red Cross to support the Haitian effort. Are there communities across the country?
The best way now is to communicate with the radio station, Haitian radio stations, and the consulate of Haiti in New York, which is the best way if you want to contact somebody. But I can say that if you have family, there is a number that they gave. You can contact it. It's 888-407-4747. It's from the State Department. If you want to, if you have family in Haiti, and then you want to know about, but and this line is very busy.
Right.
If you receive a message, you have to try again.
Jean Robert, thank you so much.
And you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Well, you've heard then from your brother. Is the rest of your family all right? Or
yes, my brother is all right, but I have other families who live in those areas really affected by the earthquake, which is Pétionville. And I haven't heard from them yet, but I'm trying to see if I can get in touch with them.
Jean-Robert Saville from Radio Soleil in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, just ahead, we'll speak with the executive director of the Boston-based Partners in Health program. I've been working, doing quite effective work in Haiti for years, and we'll ask them their point of view, what's going on. Meanwhile, here are some other scenes, some snapshots coming out from the Associated Press. The president of Haiti says he thinks thousands of people are dead after yesterday's quake. We mentioned government buildings destroyed. Also, the headquarters of UN peacekeepers destroyed by the quake. 100 people now reported missing at the UN. In one hillside district in Port-au-Prince, survivors can be heard screaming for help from inside wrecked hospitals. Four-story buildings collapsed. We'll have more in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're following events in Haiti after last night's massive earthquake. Aftershocks continue as we speak. Communication is very difficult. One person trying to reach colleagues is Ophelia Dahl. She's executive director and, along with Dr. Paul Farmer, one of the co-founders of Partners in Health, the Boston-based nonprofit healthcare organization, which has done extensive, lauded work in Haiti. Ophelia joins us in the studio. And Ophelia, before this earthquake, Haiti was still recovering from devastating hurricanes in 2008. But those hurricanes affected a smaller area. What are you hearing about the extent of the damage from the earthquake?
The damage from this earthquake is far more extensive than was thought. I think even though the epicenter was just a little south of Port-au-Prince, we've heard reports of the earthquake tremors not only being felt up in the central plateau and north, but actually buildings having fallen down in the Artibonite Valley.
So that's way north?
That's way north. That's sort of halfway up the country and in the flat areas that was affected by the hurricanes.
And how about south?
We've heard reports of the earthquake damage south to Jacmel on the coast and also across the southern peninsula all the way to Lake Hai and probably beyond that. So it's, even though the epicenter is directed around Port-au-Prince, we're going to see, I think, that the actual damage from this is covers a great deal of the country. And my guess is that in the next few days and weeks, weakened buildings will continue to fall down, even if there are no more aftershocks.
In fact, you just were hearing of a building that fell that you have workers in.
Yes, we just heard of a building in the in a place called Petite Riviere in the Artibonite Valley that has fallen down, and the casualties are making their way to other hospitals in the Central Plateau, including ours.
And that's like 10 hours after the original earthquake.
Yeah, more than that.
Ophelia, on your website this morning, we read an urgent email from Port-au-Prince from Louise Ivers, your clinical director in Haiti. It pretty much said Port-au-Prince is devastated, lots of deaths, SOS, SOS. Please help us, pain meds, bandages needed. What are you hearing now a few hours later?
Actually, Louise Ivers and another colleague have been evacuated from the UNDP site to a field base closer to the airport. And there are reports of a lot of casualties that are coming there with only one doctor and no medical supplies still.
Now, well, your headquarters in Haiti is about 100 miles north of Port-au-Prince, we understand, and the earthquake was felt there, but luckily no damage. And your team is heading to Port-au-Prince. What do they hope to do?
I think they'd like to establish field hospitals in different places. We have warehouses filled with medical supplies, which will only last a short amount of time, and also trying to liaise with other relief organizations to make sure that the immediate supplies of food and water particularly get through.
Do you have heavy machinery? Because it feels as if that's so needed right now to get people out.
Heavy machinery will be key. We have four-wheel drive vehicles, which we don't know how useful they'll be and how accessible the roads are.
What are you hearing from Haitians? We just heard from a radio station in Brooklyn, and they're hearing from Haitians who feel that this has some sort of religious overtone to it. And you know, so what are you hearing, and how much more might there be a problem if people panic?
You know, it's hard given Haiti's recent history and indeed its entire history. It's hard not to see, some kind of biblical overtones to this. But the truth is that Haiti is fragile because of decades and decades of interference and difficult governance and not a great deal of support from the countries that you would have hoped would support Haiti.
Such as?
Everything from the U.S. government to European governments. Haiti is extremely close to the U.S. and is very connected to the U.S. was not very long ago, only a couple of hundred years ago, the richest country in the Western Hemisphere. So its impoverishment has taken place relatively quickly, and that has led to its own fragility, everything from deforestation onwards. And the insecurity that is there already has just been made worse. Last year we heard about a school that collapsed in the hills of Port-au-Prince just because of heavy rains. So you can imagine the widespread devastation around Port-au-Prince.
Well, we hear the first reporters have landed, and I think that means some military helicopters possibly have landed. What can people do?
I think the first thing that people can do is to find organizations like Partners in Health in which they can pledge financial support. Because if there are groups that already have connections to Haiti, getting supplies in is going to be absolutely key.
One of the things that's being tweeted a lot on the BostonHaitian.com website is be careful of this. There's already scams out there. So
yeah.
Find an organization like yours that already has ties with Haiti.
I think that's probably correct. The word that we have had from this field hospital just outside of Port-au-Prince, where one of our medical doctors, a colleague, is stationed at the moment, is that there is, only one doctor and no supplies. So when we say supplies, we're talking about everything from bandages to antibiotics to painkillers, as well as food and water.
But you don't want people to box that up and send that to you. You need money so that you can buy it through the channels that you buy it through and get it there.
Exactly. Partners in Health, that's been working in Haiti now for 25 years, has over 100 doctors, 600 nurses and auxiliaries already set to go across the country and to help. We have our operating rooms standing ready, and we have reports that they're already coming into our hospitals and making their way from the most devastated areas.
Yeah. Remind us, we've heard it, but just remind us, what were the problems, especially the health problems in Haiti before this?
Well, there's chronic malnutrition. There's widespread lack of healthcare coverage in any respect. So you have a population that's already weakened. So, you know, the deaths from diseases like malaria and just basic lack of access to water and food insecurities mean that this is a population that is dying of entirely preventable and treatable diseases all the time. Partners in Health covers about a third of the country with its partners, Zami La Santé. So we are helping to beef up the infrastructure with the government and Ministry of Health of Haiti through public hospitals and public clinics.
And that's what you were trying to do before this, so that need's going to be even more now.
Yes.
Ophelia Dahl, Executive Director, and along with Dr. Paul Farmer, one of the co-founders of Partners in Health. It's a Boston-based nonprofit healthcare organization. They've done extensive and terrific, much lauded work in Haiti before today, and you know, obviously they're going to continue that. At our website, we'll give you more information, hereandnow.org. Ophelia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, that's hereandnow.org. We'll link you to aid agencies and also to bostonhaitian.com to follow American Haitians following the story, Here and Now. A new opinion poll suggests the people of Afghanistan are becoming more optimistic about their country. More than 1,500 Afghans were questioned last month in a poll commissioned by the BBC, ABC News, and ARD of Germany. 70% said they believed Afghanistan was going in the right direction, compared to only 40% a year ago. And 62% said they supported NATO troops in the country, a rise of 3% over last year. The poll asked about 50 questions, and the BBC's Alan Little reports on this new mood in the city of Herat in western Afghanistan.
Herat is a tumultuous, teeming kaleidoscope of a place. It sits on an ancient trading crossroads, and the bustling markets that cluster around the honey-coloured stone walls of the imposing fortress at its heart suggest an economy that endures despite everything. Down a muddy, narrow side street amid the chaotic tangle of the city, Radio Fariat, an FM talk station, runs its morning phone-in show. Today, the talk is all of the corruption at the heart of Afghanistan's governing structures. The poll found 95% of Afghans believe this to be a major impediment to progress. But the show's co-host, Feroz Kayem, agrees with the main findings of the poll, a surge in confidence that Afghanistan is moving in the right direction.
One positive thing is that under the current government, a lot of tribal tensions have ended. People are also happy that the international community is backing the country, and people are pleased with the construction. We now have more roads, we have more electricity.
It is consistent with today's poll. Last year, only 29% of Afghans thought their job prospects and economic outlook were good. Today, that has risen to 41%. We went to Herat's industrial estate and into the dark and cavernous interior of a thriving little aluminium plant. The factory employs 70 people, 10 more than last year. Its owner says the market is there for further growth. One of the beneficiaries is Gula Lai, until last year an unemployed drug addict. Now, with a job, he has a stake in the future. I wasn't even able to pay my rent before, he told me, but in the last few months things have improved for me a lot. Herat's Chamber of Commerce says this factory is just one of 350 small industrial businesses that have taken root here since 2003, creating 40,000 jobs. Create jobs and you draw the young into employment and away from the battlefield. The war against the Taliban is economic as well as military. Alhaj Turialai Gaswi is one of the city's leading businessmen.
All of us in Herat got together. We wrote to the president, and he sacked corrupt officials here. This made security better. We thought that if we worked together, we could make our situation better. And if we help to get work for people, then that means the people won't make our province insecure.
The poll also suggests that Afghans are more confident in their security and have more faith in NATO troops. Last year, 36% of Afghans blamed Western forces for the country's violence. Far fewer, only 27%, blamed the Taliban. Now, that's reversed. Today, 42% blame the Taliban and only 17% the Afghan government and its NATO allies. But the newfound confidence is fragile. Fargus Zia is a wealthy Herat doctor. Last year, her 10-year-old son was kidnapped for ransom and held for 16 days. It traumatized her entire family. She cannot yet feel safe.
We don't open our door after dusk. My son worries when he hears noises outside. Security has improved over the last few months, but I still worry that the situation is very fragile.
That report from the BBC's Alan Little in Afghanistan. And we're also keeping an eye on Haiti for you. Thousands are believed to have died. Aftershocks continue after last night's earthquake. Go to hereandnow.org for more. We'll be back with Northern Ireland's scandal, Here and Now.
Personal troubles for the two top political leaders in Northern Ireland are rippling across that province in a very public way. Peter Robinson, Northern Ireland's first minister, has stepped aside temporarily amid allegations that he helped his wife Iris cover up financial and sexual improprieties.
I continue to contend that I've acted ethically and properly, and it's particularly painful at a time of great personal trauma and turmoil that I have to defend myself from an unfounded and mischievous allegation.
Meanwhile, Robinson's former enemy, Gerry Adams, who's now leader of the Sinn Féin party, is alleged to have kept quiet about claims that his brother sexually abused his own daughter, Adams' niece.
Hindsight's a great person to have at any meeting. All I know is that my concern was to ensure that no one else was being abused, to ensure that those who were abused had every assistance and support.
Well, let's bring in David Sharrock in Belfast. He's Ireland correspondent for the London Times. And David, how is the region reacting to all of this?
Well, Robin, it has to be said that it would have been extraordinary for one of these scandals to have broken in the past few weeks. For two, just looks unbelievable in many ways. Both of them came via television documentaries made by local investigative news teams. Frankly, people are still absolutely stunned. They're reeling from the enormity of it all.
And of course, these are two men who have been charged with forging a government together.
Well, indeed, yes, that's what makes it all the more compelling, I suppose. Although Peter Robinson would be much more in the limelight. He's First Minister, the top politician in Northern Ireland. Gerry Adams is leader of Sinn Féin, but has much more of a sort of back office role these days.
Well, let's take a look at Peter Robinson's story. Again, he's the first minister, as you said, stepped aside. He says to help his wife Iris deal with allegations that she had an affair in her late 50s with a young man who was then in his late teens and allegedly raised money to help him start a business. What is the latest that we're hearing on this?
Because there has been such a roller coaster of events, you speak to me in a sort of a pause or a hiatus following Mr. Robinson's inevitable stepping down or stepping aside. So now we wait and see. Mr. Robinson says that he will be away out of office for a maximum of 6 weeks and he will clear his name. He's getting strong public backing from Arlene Foster, the interim or stand-in First Minister, and other senior party officers. But I have to say that's on the record, they're saying that. Behind the scenes, it's a different picture altogether, and right now, I would have my doubts that Mr. Robinson will be returning to office. Just have to wait and see.
And to Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams, after that television documentary spoke of claims that his brother, Liam, had sexually abused his own daughter, Gerry Adams did speak publicly and spoke about his father being a sexual abuser. How stunning has all of this been?
The really fascinating part in this is the similarity in the approach to these scandals both Mr. Adams and Mr. Robinson have taken. Perhaps Mr. Robinson took a lead from Mr. Adams. What Mr. Adams did after the documentary went out was basically try to regain control of the story by giving an interview in which he revealed that his father, Gerry Sr., had sexually abused some of his children. He wasn't specific about who. He was asked whether he had been a victim, and he said he had no recollection of that. And that, of course, garnered him a lot of sympathy that he was a victim of sexual abuse. But it didn't last very long because there was a suspicion which grew that he was trying to deflect attention from himself. And indeed, a number of claims he'd made about the efforts he'd made to impel his brother to go to the authorities were shot down in flames by a number of newspaper reports.
Well, and we remind ourselves that there were reports that this was years ago when the Catholic members of Sinn Féin might not have wanted to go to the authorities with an issue like this because they were the largely Protestant authorities.
Well, yes, and indeed further digging produced a quote from Mr. Adams as recently as the mid-90s in which he publicly urged people not to go to the police with such matters, because he claimed that these would be used for the security forces' own militaristic ends, which was his phrase. So that was kind of interpreted as it may be used to blackmail them into becoming informers on the Republican mm-hmm. movement.
Right. Well, David Sherrick, you've been covering Ireland from the beginning of the peace process that culminated in the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. So how are both of these scandals, the Robinson and the Adams scandals, on two different ends of the political spectrum, affecting what is still a very fragile peace?
Unusually, the Robinson scandal, as of now, looks like it might have some positive effect on a political impasse which has been basically holding things up here for the best part of a year now, which is the transfer of policing and justice powers from direct rural ministers in London to the local government, the local administration in Belfast. These have been described as the last pieces in the jigsaw of the peace process. It all sounds much grander than it actually is. I mean, policing and justice powers basically means day-to-day running of the courts and resourcing of the local police force. The impact of this has been that the Democratic Unions have been very reluctant to transfer these powers, but Peter Robinson is in a desperate situation at the moment. He's battling to stay in office. If he cannot get these powers transferred in the next few weeks, then Sinn Féin has the perfect excuse now to pull the plug, say that we're not continuing with this process, and that would force local elections. And in the current climate, Mr. Robinson's party would do extremely badly in the wake of these revelations. Now, in the case of Gerry Adams, his situation is rather different. He is the leader of a party which he controls absolutely. At the moment, I don't hear any inklings that people would be wanting to get rid of him because they think that he's a political liability because of this scandal, even though, when you look at it, what Mr. Adams has been involved in, or allegedly involved in, is far more serious than the charges that Mr. Robinson currently faces.
David Sherrick, Ireland correspondent for the London Times, joining us from the BBC studios in Belfast. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, on this note, on today's top story, there are reports of aftershocks as aid from around the world heads to Haiti after what's being called the worst earthquake in that country's history. Humanitarian officials say it's too soon to gauge the extent of damage or the number of lives lost, but the Red Cross estimates 3 million people need help immediately. Communication is difficult, but as we went to air, we received this email from Nancy Dorsonville of the Harvard School of Public Health, who is in Haiti. She writes, "Situation very bad. First internet connection. On my way to General Hospital to help. Everything on and off. Every few minutes, earth shakes. We're not sure if aftermath or more to come. Mixed reports. We'll try to stay in touch. Thanks for caring." For more, go to hereandnow.org. We'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back. Remember that incredible memoir from Herman Rosenblatt, who said he met the love of his life through a barbed wire fence in a concentration camp? Or Margaret Jones' story of growing up a gang member in L.A.? Or maybe you can reach back to homemaker Penelope Ash's steamy 60s tell-all, Naked Came the Stranger. Well, they were all fakes. Naked Came the Stranger was made up by newspaper reporters. Margaret Jones, the alleged drug addict, had never been near a gang in her life. And Herman Rosenblatt, who claimed to escape the Nazis, well, he confessed he just wanted to tell people a happy story. Well, they join a long line of hoaxers, including Mark Twain, and then the malicious author of The Protocols of Zion, who hoped to spread the lie of a Jewish plan for world domination. Author Melissa Katsoulis has collected their stories in a fascinating new book, Literary Hoaxes, An Eye-Opening History of Famous Frauds. She joins us from the BBC studios in London. Melissa, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Mark Twain, a hoaxer?
He's one of my favorites. I mean, everyone knows he's a great writer with the gift of the gab and an amazing imagination. But I think many of his early readers, when he was first a young journalist in Virginia City, swallowed a lot more than they should have done when they were reading his work.
On slow days, he'd just make things up.
He did, and they now seem like incredibly tall tales that nobody could believe. They often had amazing clues in them.
Here's one from 1862. A petrified Shah, S-H-A-H, was found some time ago in the mountains south of Gravelly Ford. Every limb and feature of the stone mummy was perfect, not even excepting the left leg, which had evidently been a wooden one during the lifetime of the owner. People bought it.
Completely. And of course, he very cleverly said he was astonished that anyone believed it. You know, he didn't mean to trick anyone. How could people possibly believe this nonsense? But people did. I guess it was the early days of sensationalist journalism, and that's what they wanted to read.
You say there are actually three kind of genres, subsets of hoaxes. What are they?
There are hoaxes that are done for entrapment. Someone wants to prick the pretensions of a rival or another academic, for example. Then there are some that are done for artistic ends. You know, maybe someone really wants, a poet wants to find a new voice in their work, so they kind of inhabit the character of someone else. But perhaps the ones that we're most familiar with today are those that are done simply to get money and fame. We associate those with memoir. I think that's the genre we would most associate that with.
Well, then there's also the nefarious hoaxes. And to me, in reading your book, the one that stands out the most is The Protocols of Zion, written by a Russian secret police officer purporting to be a meeting of Jewish leaders seeking world domination. What kind of life did that take on?
Well, I think that's an example of, you know, the terrible power of a text in history. I mean, here was something which in retrospect looks pretty ridiculous. Unfortunately, that is still taken as gospel, if that's the right word, in some countries still today. It's been used consistently over the decades and now centuries as ammunition for anti-Semitic propagandists. And it's really taken on an unpleasant life of its own.
Well, Hitler referred to it.
He did, and of course that's not the only hoax he's been involved in after his death.
Well, after his death, he was the subject of a hoax, the Hitler Diaries.
I think that's an example of a terrible forgery, but a great hoax, because actually the Hitler Diaries, if you read them, are really very badly written.
Well, you remind us, in the Hitler Diaries, Hitler complains of his terrible flatulence and bad breath.
He does, and he says, "Now a year is nearly over. Have I achieved my goals? Must get tickets for the Olympics for Eva." I mean, you couldn't make it up.
But somebody did.
They did indeed.
Who did? Who made it up?
Well, it was a money-hungry guy whose name was Kujau. Forgive me, German people, if I'm pronouncing that wrong. And he, of course, realised there was a massive market. I mean, you can imagine the thirst for information about Hitler's private thoughts.
Well, and he told people that the books, each covering a six-month period in Hitler's life, had been found in the wreckage of a plane crash in East Germany at the end of the war and fallen into the hands of an official who sold it to an antique dealer. This is sort of how many of the frauds make their way to the media. People are told, oh, dealers had it and they gave it to some other dealer.
There's always a kind of shady chain of events that leads to these amazing books suddenly turning up. And that's been the case ever since some of the earliest literary hoaxes back in the 18th century, like the poems of Thomas Chatterton. They always would appear in a locked casket in the storeroom of an old church in the West Country or something, and, you know, miraculous.
And tell us about these poems of Chatterton.
Chatterton was a boy in Bristol in the West Country of England in the 18th century who was a really talented poet, but he was never going to get anywhere as a writer. He couldn't afford to sort of apply himself to go to London and try and make it a profession. So he said he'd found these medieval poems by a guy called Rowley. And they're really good. I mean, people still love them now. He made them up for years and years and years. And in the end, it did allow him to fulfill his dream at first. It took him to London. He was able to get great interest from some literary luminaries of the day. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough to save him. And he came to a very tragic end. He killed himself when he was just a teenager. But he was a great genius.
But it reminds us that they do achieve a sort of immortality, the hoaxers.
I think they do. I mean, many of them are more famous than others. There are lots in my book that we've probably never heard of now.
Tell us your favorite. I mean, someone that no one's ever heard of, but what they've done is so incredible.
Okay, I think my very favorite hoax is one that dates from 19th century Paris. There was a guy called Franc-Denis Lucas, and he was a Frenchman who spectacularly duped the entire Parisian Academy and all the leading academics of his day by selling them a dossier of letters purporting to be from great historical figures. And they were all letters which sang the glory of France, or Gaul as it would have been, from people like Cleopatra, Mary Magdalene, Alexander the Great, all written in perfect idiomatic 19th century French. You have Cleopatra saying, "Dear Caesar, having a wonderful holiday here in Gaul, the food's great and the schools are truly excellent. I really think we should send our son here to be educated. Love, Cleopatra." And it's unbelievable that anybody would think this could be true, but they did.
Where do you think we are with hoaxes? You know, James Fry, one of the most recent. Do you think they're just going to continue?
I think they will. I mean, obviously the internet now plays a really important role in publishing of this kind, both in debunking hoaxes, but also in allowing anyone to get online and publish in that way what they claim to be the truth. And I think, as we've seen with A Million Little Pieces by the author you just mentioned, it can actually cause quite devastating fallout.
Because the things that are written about, people are suffering. Real people are really suffering.
That's right. I mean, you know, it is one thing for someone who's genuinely suffered from abuse or addiction to talk about it, but it means something very different if you're inventing that and passing it off as truth.
No. That's author Melissa Katsoulis. Her book is Literary Hoaxes, An Eye-Opening History of Famous Frauds. And Melissa, we mentioned the eye-opening part. One of our producers was shocked to learn that one of her favorite books, Go Ask Alice, which was supposed to be a cautionary tale of a high school girl, you know, exploring the world of drugs, and she becomes hooked and overdoses, was a fake.
Let me say, I too was devastated to discover this was a fake. I had no idea. I grew up with the book, as many people in their 30s and 40s will have done. But no, it was all written by this kindly Mormon grandmother, Beatrice Sparks, who had the best interests of our feckless youth at heart and thought, well, this is clearly the right way to put them off.
Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you.